You ready?
Hello and welcome to Psych in the City podcast. I'm your host, Sarah Kelleher. Today, I'm interviewing Reb Holmberg, aka Mistress Amanda Wildfire. It's a spicy one. Reb Holmberg, aka Mistress Amanda Wildfire, is a professional dominatrix, writer, performer, and BDSM educator practicing in Minneapolis and worldwide. For over 30 years, they have contributed to the BDSM scene by offering workshops on a wide variety of topics, including predicament bondage, suspension, mummification, pony play, electro play, genitorture, and switching for tops. They are currently studying with the Institute for Sexuality Education and Enlightenment towards sex educator certification. This episode starts with us talking about how we came to the Institute for Sexuality Education and Enlightenment, aka IC, to continue our sex educator journeys. It's where Reb and I were introduced to each other and where we met. We then discuss some of Reb's history and specialties as a professional dominatrix for over 30 years.
Yeah, I am.
Okay.
So I wound up talking to the dean of students, and I wanted to make sure that being a dominatrix wasn't going to, you know, I mean, I did graduate from Brown University, but that was, you know, a while ago, like many decades ago. And so they said, no, in fact, that would be a benefit to our program. But I'm not sure that we have that many classes that are really applicable to your field of study. Primarily, I wanted to take all of the introductory letters that people had written me over the years and do a qualitative and quantitative analysis in terms of how many people asked for bondage, how many people asked for cross-dressing, how many people mentioned that they were married, how many people mentioned that they had never seen a dominatrix before, and many of them would handwrite me their life story.
Oh, wow.
I thought that would be kind of an interesting thing to publish a something or other on.
So like a study of inquiries that you have gotten over the years.
Yes. In fact, I have a whole, let's see, maybe 15 years worth of paper introductory letters that I have saved. They're in my basement. From all over the country and all over the world. Because back in the day, you used to write to a PO box and then wait, you know, you'd have to wait a couple of weeks for the mistress to write back to you. So it was this whole screening process and this whole sort of journey. Nowadays, it's like, hey, mistress, what's up? You know?
Totally, yeah.
Right? And so there's this moment where, that beautiful handwritten letter that would convey so much detail about the person. And even the style of cursive would tell me like really how old the person was and what sort of personality they were, the handwriting, the language that they used. Long story short, it turns out that their program could not help me. But he said, you know, you have a lot of really great information that the sex education community could use, but you need ASEC certification. And so that's a certification that one receives after studying with the ASEC program.
So tell me about yourself. Tell me about your work. Tell me about, you know, give us a little bit of insight into who you are, into what you do.
I feel like I've had a number of different perspectives on both the BDSM scene in general and on professional dominance. So I've worked as a professional dominatrix full-time in the Midwest in Minneapolis for over 30 years. And I came out into BDSM in 1989. I started meeting some women who were very interested in bondage and discipline. And I went to a music festival and met this huge group of women who were all teaching each other basic BDSM and negotiation. And fortunately for me, they took a shine to me and they drew me in because I was a stranger to them. But at music festivals, especially when it's like a week long, people get friendly. So, and they were all from the medical establishment. So a hospital administrator, EMT, nurses, then that's how they had all learned, you know, about each other and then shared their interest in BDSM.
That's awesome.
And it was a very didactic process. You had to learn all the safety and all the negotiation and all of the safe word protocols and before they would really let you play. So I feel like I was very fortunate to stumble into this group, and that became my origin story.
Were you experimenting prior to meeting them?
Oh, yeah.
At all within BDSM?
Absolutely. I was one of those kinky little girls. My little secret was that I fantasized about bondage and discipline and punishment and ownership, really to the exclusion of anything else. Whenever I found something erotic, and I was, I guess, early in my erotic discoveries, after I went to the movie Fantasia with my mother, there was an erotic scene of some centaurs getting tied up with vines to make them more beautiful and more attractive. And I thought, yeah, whatever that is, whatever they're doing, that's very interesting to me. And I started fantasizing about, you know, ponies and saddles. So I was very into that idea of not necessarily being with a horse, but being with a centaur. Mm. And that just kind of like, never fantasized about dating boys or holding hands. It was all about, you know, getting whipped or being put in chastity or being drugged and then forced to, you know, make out with somebody while you were tied up. And I feel like being in that world erotically kind of made me immune to all of the other things that people fall into, like early relationships or being very sexually active, young. Nothing in my world really reflected my interests. And so I just thought I was the only one, you know, I thought I was the only person that ever thought about any of these things, and that it was just, you know, something that I just kept to myself. It wasn't until maybe high school and college that, I had a crush on somebody, and I used to fantasize about him all tied up and me whispering in his ear and touching him. And he would be, no, don't touch me there. You know, that kind of thing. Probably a little bit from the Batman and Robin series, where there are a lot of bondage scenes and they're always tied up together. And Catwoman comes in and, you know, gloats about having the Caped Crusader all tied up. So that was kind of my childhood, beginning play probably in college. Playing role play games like vampires and victims and things like that. But I was not a normal average girl. I liked to take the lead, and I had a pretty broad erotic imagination. And so, I guess it just came naturally. You know, it was something that I felt was a part of me.
How did you find community? Did you ever share with a close friend or somebody that this was kind of what you felt? And how was the first experience or initial experiences telling people, if that ever happened? I mean, I imagine nerve-wracking.
Honestly, in the 80s, it was considered kind of impossible. It was really not on anyone's radar. Nobody was coming out. The closest thing we had was, because of the AIDS crisis, there would be a variety of celebrities that had passed of AIDS, and there were rumors that they might have been gay. So it's very different from today. And to me, it was part of my feeling rebellious. In my 20s, I was very clear on not wanting to get married, have children, and live in the suburbs. And so part of my identity was that I was not kind of this normal heterosexual girl. And I did not find community until I came out as queer. In the late 80s, I ran a women's nightclub. There were, I guess, more opportunities for me to meet people. And I did meet people who were not just interested in lesbianism, but interested in sex and interested in power and interested in ways for women specifically in that group to feel powerful, and playing power games, dominance, submission, pain, pleasure, all of those things factored into feeling empowered, because all of those things were at that time considered impossible for women. You know, it wasn't possible for a woman to be assertive. It wasn't possible for a woman to be dominant. It wasn't possible for a woman to feel pleasure or give pleasure. We were supposed to be this sort of inert, reproductive beings who washed dishes and fed the dog and made sure the kids got to school. Like, we did not have sexual agency in the way that we have it now. So I guess it felt very powerful to just be able to talk about these things, who meet with other powerful women who were also part of that sort of underground swell of, you know, coming out as lesbians or coming out as bisexual. And naturally we would start to talk about what we like to do in bed or what we like to do to feel even more powerful.
What was the name of the nightclub that you ran?
Hepburn's.
Mm. So how did you get into, how did you start being a professional dominatrix?
Basically, I would travel all around the country with this wonderful all these lesbians and bisexual women. We had like kind of a crew of people that would go to different conventions. And again, there was no internet. So in order to find community, you really had to go to a BDSM convention or like a leather fest type of situation. So you would go there and then you would meet people from other areas. There were some leather clubs that would sponsor these events. So that's really how you met people back then. You couldn't just, you know, jump online and go, okay, FetLife, you know, let's see, there's a rope group in Minneapolis and a group for fisting, and oh, okay, there's a lesbian group that's discussing, you know, manacles and Metal Gear. You know, like, it's not like now where it really is like a full menu of really interesting activities. So
you had to try really hard and be really intentional about seeking out this community.
Absolutely. And you felt like a pioneer. I mean, it was definitely like pioneer spirit, because you were looking for something and you were brave enough to show up, and you were, you know, it was not as common. So it was unfamiliar and exciting and brave. Like, everybody was kind of, I wouldn't say tough, but we were all very much bonded over the fact that we were brave enough to do this.
Yeah, you can't text and be like, are you going tonight? You just showed up and took the chance.
That's right. That's right. And and lucky for me, I had a posse. So
yeah.
So how I became a pro dom was that I would come home and there would be no one to talk to. There was nobody in the community here, because there was no community. There were only a couple of people, and I had very specific interests. And so somebody said to me rather casually, you're tall and you're good looking. Why aren't you a dom? You can be a pro dom. And at that time, I really wanted to have enough money to travel even more freely, like to go to all of the conventions and buy all the equipment and seduce all the girls. You know, like, I was just very much like, yeah, let's do all of this. And at that point, I had never physically dominated a man. But I felt as though with some books from the gay bookstore, I could figure out, like magazines and things like that, I could figure it out. And I was not afraid of reading all of the gay men's magazines and seeing, you know, cock and ball bondage or what men liked. So I was like, okay, well, if gay men like this, and, you know, if a straight man is submissive, he probably likes at least some of those things. And I had taught safer sex, and I had taught, I had been a one of the early representatives of Good Vibrations here in Minnesota. Long story short, I started looking for work, and I called around to Dominant Dames, which was one group, and Aggressive Women, which was another group. And they were basically doing out calls, and a couple of the places had dungeons. And without spinning this into an even longer version, which I guess you'll have to read my book, I got a job and was able to start working. And interestingly, at that time, there weren't any lifestyle DOMs in Minneapolis. And what I mean by that is people who were fully kitted out, had learned about consent negotiation, equipment safety, safer practices like, you know, cleaning your toys in a certain way. I immediately sort of set about teaching the other pros that I met, you know, what I knew. And I was very happy and very successful almost overnight. I was very, very happy for the first time in my life, really.
Wow.
But like I had a job that suited me, you know?
How has your work, you know, being a pro dom for over 30 years, I imagine the landscape has drastically shifted. In what ways for you personally has your work transformed over the years? Like whether it be related to how you find community, meet clients, meet, you know, like how is it? And also personally, like what has shifted for you?
I guess the most important thing is that people are a lot less ashamed, right? So the first 10 years was this cat and mouse game. There wasn't a whole lot of like support for people who are in the adult industry. There wasn't a lot of organization around it. That came when the internet really kicked in. So people were afraid and ashamed, and they were afraid of me, and they were afraid that I was a cop, and they were afraid that the cops were going to raid at any minute, or they were afraid that they would, you know, go to prison for wanting a dildo in them. You know what I mean? Like it was a much more sort of dicey kind of situation, much like the situation with weed. If you wanted to buy some weed in 1989 or 1990, it was a scary, harrowing process. It was not just like a casual, like, oh, okay, this person has that strain, this person has that, I'll just wander over to the store and see, you know, or I'll call my dealer or whatever. Like back then it was edgy, right? So I fell in love with my clients, and not in a romantic sense, but in the idea that they were brave too, that they were interested in something that went categorically against all of their socialization, all of the workplace requirements for them to have a wife and two children and to, you know, behave in a certain way, dress in a certain way. So that was really a revelation. Nowadays, right, people come in and they're like, oh yeah, yeah, I wear a latex cat suit under my business suit all the time. And I got tattoos and I have nipple rings, and, you know, or somebody will show up and say, look, mistress, I have, you know, this chastity device and this chastity device, and I've tried them both. And I wondered if you had any other ones that I could try. Like they're very knowledgeable. They're less shame filled. They're less afraid of me. They're much more conversant, and they understand negotiation and consent to a much greater degree. I think there were a lot of clients in my first 10 years who thought that since I was the dominatrix or the mistress, whatever I said went, you know, like whatever I say goes. And so they didn't have the idea of agency within a submissive persona for themselves. And I think some of them had experiences where, you know, their boundaries had really been seriously transgressed, and they hadn't understood that BDS, true BDSM, is about a power exchange and a mutual respect. Even if you're, you know, shoving your foot down someone's throat and telling them to, you know, lick it, right? So, that is the main difference, I think. Yeah,
that must be really amazing to see and feel just with your clients too, like a less shame just overall. Like, what a gift. Almost, because it is a scary thing, I think, to reckon with the things that we desire and want, especially if they're socialized as very deviant or weird or gross or something. And so that's really cool that people, now that you've sensed that people are coming just with more knowledge and more understanding and like more acceptance that this is okay. Mm-hmm. What are your specialties and what is, you know, what is your work now? So you are an independent pro dom.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I only worked for other people for about a year and a half and then started my own place.
Oh.
And was very fortunate just to be in the right place at the right time. And was able to build my studio. People, clients, friends came out of the woodwork to help me. Get the word out. My special fetish is bondage. And I think part of it was that I realized once a man was tied up, then I felt good about him. I felt attracted or interested or focused on him in a way that I didn't feel that way when the person wasn't tied up. Maybe it was just from my early experience of thinking that bondage was interesting or attractive at 5 years old, right? And then being further stimulated by watching Batman and Robin tied up by Catwoman in the old series, in the old series. And feeling like real irritation when they would escape, right? Like real annoyance that whoever was in charge of the bondage had not done a good job, and the Batman or Robin always escaped before the chainsaw or the, you know, the giant rotating cleaver or something like that got to them. Not that I wanted to see them hurt, but rather there's, you know, there was something more to the bondage. There should have been something more to the bondage. So, and I had a string of clients who wanted to be tied up this way or that way, or experience certain kinds of restrictions. I think in part because it gave them permission to be submissive. It was a context. It was a contextual thing. I don't know if you've read Come As You Are by Emily Nagoski.
Yes.
So it's all about accelerators, right? And so bondage was an accelerator. It was something that said, yes, yes, go ahead. You know, and put the person in the headspace of being receptive. And, you know, when we look at popular culture, we see a lot of pictures of women tied up, you know, and we see a lot of, you know, women in gags. Even in BDSM porn, it's almost always a female that's being tied up, spanked, whatever. And so to be able to experience that yourself is actually, or even see images like that, are very rare for men in our culture, in American culture. So it's that novelty too of feeling at someone's mercy, but safely, and in a context that is an accelerator, that is a yes, that is a big yes. So I became a specialist in bondage, started collecting all different kinds of restriction gear, everything from immobilization to predicaments to isolation techniques, mummification. And the challenge, of course, was to do it safely and comfortably, and to encourage people to really deeply relax. Some of them are techniques that you'll see even today with adult swaddling and things like that. So the other specialty that I'm probably known for best is rubber dolly, which is like a form of cross-dressing. Typically, a man is dressed in multiple layers of rubber until a female shape is created. There's a doll hood. And again, it's that idea of the big yes. Like, okay, if you're a doll, you don't really have any mission. You don't have any job to do. You don't have to figure anything out. Your logical brain is kind of shut off. And physical experience and a visual experience many times.
Meaning like, becoming a doll frees you into that. I can kind of do nothing, don't have to think about anything, and kind of can lean into whatever because I have no responsibilities right now.
Yes. And it is for, I think, a certain type of person. I'm not going to say, you know, I think the cliche is, you know, the powerful man or the CEO or something like that. I think a lot of men in my experience, I should say, feel weighed down by the constraints placed upon their behavior in everyday society. So even if you have lots of money and you've made lots of money and you've played by the rules and you have the 2.5 children and the house with the green lawn and the wife who's, you know, picture perfect and keeps her, has kept her figure, as they say, all of the check marks, maybe you have a boat, maybe you have a car and then a sports car and then a pool in the backyard. You have all of those things in American society, but you don't really have any variety. You have to behave in a very conformist way. And I think there are lots of men who would like to be more emotional, more emotive, or they would like to have different things to wear if they wanted to, or they would like to have something other than a businessman haircut. But their lifestyle, the definition of the successful man in America, doesn't allow for any kind of real personal freedom around expression. And if they do, they're called eccentric or a faggot, or, you know, there's an immediate like sense of having failed to meet the standards of masculinity in our culture. So my dungeon is kind of like a safe haven for those people who would like to experience this particular slice of powerlessness, femininity, receptivity, penetrability, all of these experiences that can be freeing, because it does feel like rather rebellious, like, you know, screw you, I'm going to do all these things anyway, and I'm going to let a woman do it. And yeah, this is my trip. This is my game. I think there's lots of other ways that men can express this. But there is a certain percentage of men who deeply enjoy this, and they come in categories, right? They come in categories. So it must be like a thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like something in the group mind that brings them.
So rubber dollying.
Mm. Rubber dollying is a form of cross-dressing. I'm not even sure we're allowed to say the word cross-dressing anymore, but you have to understand that professional dominance for many years, maybe not today, strictly speaking, all across the board, but it has always relied on the gender binary and the transgression of the gender binary, where the man takes the female, in quotes, role, and the woman takes the, again, coded male role. And there are certain protocols and tropes that we'll find over and over again for that. So cross-dressing just means dressing in the clothes of the opposite binary gender, right? And some of my clients will definitely identify with the phrase gender fluid, because again, according to context, something brings out this feminine quality in them, and they would like a world, a safe world, a world that's not going to call them a faggot or a sissy, you know, maybe consensually, but not non-consensually. They want a space to experience that and embody that. But really talking about like this, you know, tip of the iceberg, 99.9% of cisgender men who have these kinds of fantasies will never wind up actually in a dungeon because of the risks, or because they are not ready, or because they're have questions, or because they're worried that it's going to make them gay. You know, there's all these things that a person might worry. Wow, you know, if I like it that much, I might never want to go back to the suburbs.
Totally, like the slippery slope fear, the whole right. With feminization. I've heard that sometimes people don't want to do that because sometimes people will want to be humiliated while they are in a feminine, you know, feeling in a or dressed in a feminine identity. And some people shy away from that because they don't want to.
They don't want to reinforce the misogyny that's inherent in the idea that wearing female clothes makes you degraded.
Right. How do you, what are you, is that a part of?
That's a great thing to bring up, because then we go to agency, right? We go to the part where the person is willingly engaging in something that they know is very transgressive, right? none of my clients really think that women are like that. However, they've had it hammered into their heads since they were kids that to have something up your ass means that you're bad, degraded, dirty, not a man. And so that is the little tiny bottleneck that they can squeeze themselves through to rationalize engaging in this behavior. And I think it also kind of harkens back to this childhood moment where maybe a boy knows that maybe there's something to sticking a finger up his butt that's kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. Or feels good.
First, yeah, or it feels good, right? And then the first social message he gets is that to get something stuck up there means that you lose the game. You're out. You know, you will no longer ever be able to play reindeer games or have a penis or all of those things are off limits to you forever. And that's the message that young boys get even now, right? That to be at all girlish kicks you out of, not only kicks you out of the club, you'll never get laid. You'll never get, you know, you're not even a human. So they revisit the trauma of that moment, not that other cisgender women or the female coded people in their lives have gone through, because there really isn't empathy there. It's a return to that crestfallen feeling of how could something that I want to do and feel so good result in such calamity for me, social calamity. So if the person goes to a dominatrix, they can relive that social calamity moment and yet go back to being a man. Guess what, guys? I got it up the ass and now I'm running the board, right? Like, I'm still okay. Playing the game and it's fine.
Nothing has changed.
Happened to me.
Yeah.
Nothing has changed. And I had a great time. And most people who, you know, most men who visit dominatrix, and there's of course now a wide variety of the types of people who might visit a professional dominatrix, but the preponderance of them are closeted cisgender men who are not out as players. They can play that game and receive the therapeutic benefit of going through that traumatic moment, survive, get to the other side, right? And then feel validated. That part of them that was so ashamed is now validated, right? And they might go right back into, you know, oh, it's so dirty that I do this, right? But everyone has their different narrative that goes through their head. Obviously, if they're in my hands, they don't really think there's anything wrong with it, because that's a lot of effort and stress and bravery to actually show up and do it. I mean, you could just sit in a hotel room with a dildo and do it yourself.
So meaning that if they've made it to you, they've already done a lot of the reckoning, at least temporarily. To even get to this point.
Absolutely. Yes. And are there people who are, you know, out there embodying dominant male assholery, even though they're submissive? Sure. Maybe that's part of their kink, right? Not every submissive is a saint. What's interesting about this is it puts people like myself and anyone in the adult industry in a really interesting position to observe this behavior. Mm. And that's why sex education by, or BDSM education by, people who are in the industry is so important, because it's a perspective that you're not going to see anywhere else.
You're often one of the only people that has access to it.
Absolutely. And people have told me this for decades, that over, you know, tens of thousands of people who visited me have said, you know, you're the only one who knows.
Totally.
Or this is the only place that I can really be myself. Or you're the only one who knows both sides of me. Mm. Now imagine, put yourself in that position. Imagine that you are a member of a sexual minority that never ever gets community, never ever gets to see themselves portrayed in a positive way. And it's almost like sympathy for the devil, right? Like in so many ways.
What do you mean? What does that mean?
Well, cisgender white men are frequently demonized in popular culture right now, especially in the on the progressive side. And you know, there's lots of really good reasons why that, you know, even they have sort of like invisible prison bars around them in a way. Maybe that's why they are the way they are.
I mean, we're all in some way, many of us have, you know, prison bars around us when it comes to aspects of our sexuality.
Yes.
And am I hearing that, you know, you feel that this benefits everyone societally for this to be an experience for people because it helps to reckon with the shame, the socialization that we go under, you know, of these very harmful kind of stereotypes and like stigmas about the gender binary and also what it means to be feminine, particularly as a cisgender man. And this is a place where people have an opportunity to experience that and ultimately kind of blend, integrate some of those feelings.
Absolutely. Now, you might not be able to, you know, create a logical diagram of one to another, but I think anything that brings into question the gender binary has the potential of adding, at least energetically, to a world that allows some people agency to be who they would like to be, or at least occasionally be who they'd like to be. And I think one of the reasons we are seeing such a resurgence of misogyny is that the more these spaces open, the fewer excuses people who are very attached to the power that pure masculinity affords them, right? The angrier they are to see everyone else be able to easily and enjoyably slip into any number of different gender experiences and then survive unscathed. There's no excuse now. And so there's this tremendous pent-up feeling of why them? Why do they get to do that? Why is it that, you know, gay men can go around having anal sex and nothing happens to them? Is some of the earliest wounds, in my opinion, right? There's no scientific base for this. I'm just going to put this out there. One of the earliest psychological wounds that a boy can experience is being told that he can't use his body, touch his body, or express his body in an effeminate, passive, receptive, penetrable way. All of those things are not allowed. And I would argue that most people are born with some masculine qualities, some feminine qualities, some qualities we probably don't have a word for. And if the more enforced the binary becomes, the more it is necessary for, especially in the United States, people assigned male at birth, they are fed this incredibly intense narrative that none of those things are allowed. And it's really scary. It's like being told, yeah, if you trip on a crack, you're going to break your mother's back. I mean, it's like that level of like, and girls, I don't know. I mean, I think our society is like, oh, capitalism was like, oh, I think girls, you know, girls can be boys when it's benefits us, you know, and then we want them to be girls again, they got to be girls, you know.
How does capitalism, you're saying, play into that?
Well, it's definitely a case of history, right? Women were supposed to be in the house taking care of men. Men were the breadwinners. And it was decided at some level or some point that it should be okay for women to work too, because that was better for the economy. So capitalism decided, yeah, women can be mothers, sure, but they should also have jobs, and they should also have strength, and they should also have purchasing power, and they should also have credit cards, and they should be able to buy things without asking their husband first, because that's better for the economy than if they are at home, you know, and not consuming, freely consuming. A woman who has her own money will spend more money than the woman who has to go to her husband. I know this sounds very old fashioned, but it actually was that way for, you know, most of the last century, that a woman would have to go to her husband and say, honey, I need money for the groceries.
A person would spend more money if there's less loopholes to get to it. So in a capitalist society, we want the most amount of people spending money.
Mm-hmm. And now we have children spending money. Now we have children with their own credit cards and their own phones and their own demographic, right?
Is creating spaces for cisgender men to experience femininity, is that a huge and important part of your work?
Yes, absolutely. I love cross-dressers, and I love the bravery it takes to cross over that boundary, right? And I feel like there's a soft spot in my heart for cross-dressers, I think, because I never felt like I particularly fulfilled the list of requirements to be feminine or a female or true woman. I never felt like that was, you know, I've always been a they, them, even before there was a they, them. I never really felt like, even if at my most feminine looking, I never felt like a girl or a woman. I've always felt like somebody who combines and is gender fluid. And yeah, so when these people came to me, I was like, you know, I get you. I remember putting on my mother's panties and thinking, wow, this is different, because they were silk and not cotton. They were silky and not cottony. Or the idea of putting makeup on, I felt like I was a butch queen, you know, trying with a beard, you know, trying on lipstick. I never felt like it was just sort of a natural part of my life. It was like a, you know, slightly transgressive thing to do, is to put on girly clothes. You know, that was somehow not quite in my wheelhouse. So yeah, cross-dressers fascinate me. And I think they also allow me to kind of view femininity in a different way. My femininity isn't expressed with vulnerability, right? It's expressed in a completely different sense.
So in witnessing and, you know, other people's perception and experience of femininity has inherently made you think about what femininity means, not only for you, but just in general, the way it's conceptualized. Absolutely. Yeah.
I think that there's a fun feeling of being such a large woman. I'm 6 feet tall, and I've always been broad-shouldered, big boned, and being able to take a cross-dresser out to dinner so that they could pass as female, right? And now that people are even more out as transgendered, it depends on what city you live in, right? You might see transgender women out and about who have physiognomies that are more like mine, right? Even though I was assigned female at birth, I always kind of felt akin to that experience. And so the pleasure that they receive from being able to pass as female, because we're both two big women together, right? And it's almost like this little smokescreen that happens, where all of a sudden it's like, you know, we went into that place and then we were called ma'ams. Like, they want to feel what it would feel like to be addressed, viewed, and approached like a woman. And perhaps some of them have leanings towards being trans feminine, but their lifestyles don't give them any opportunity except what that one time the wife dressed me up as a maid, you know, for Halloween, right? You know, like, so that many of them talk about those experiences with tremendous fondness.
Right. Yeah. What are some aspects of cross-dressing? Like, tell me about that.
It's such a broad set of experiences. Some of those experiences are sensual. In other words, women's clothes feel good. They feel positive. They feel lovely. They might feel arousing. Mm. They might just feel like a relief from wearing men's clothes because men's clothes are boring or men's clothes aren't very form-fitting, you know? So like that sort of novelty, again, quality. So it might just be a matter of wanting to wear lingerie and panties and a bra, a garter belt and stockings, high heels. And for some cross-dressers, that's enough, maybe just panties. So it really varies to the individual. Others might want to dress in a very realistic fashion. They want to pass. They want to look in the mirror and say, I make a very elegant woman, or I make a very sexy female. And to a degree that it is stereotyped presentation of certain kinds of women, like anywhere from the rich, pampered housewife on Nob Hill, or the schoolgirl or the schoolboy who has schoolgirl panties on. Mm. All these different kinds of roles factor into not just the sexuality, although certainly arousal takes, you know, center stage in many of these cases, because the lingerie itself has become sort of an erotic fixation or an accelerator. When I put panties on, that gives me permission to use my butt plug, or that gives me permission to fantasize about being penetrated or tied up. Mm. For other people, it's the restriction of a corset, thigh-high boots, a posture collar, and femininity is just sort of like the wash that allows for this behavior. Mm. But to wear a corset and high-heeled boots is not necessarily about mimicking the female. It's about feeling what it feels like to be compressed, right? Mm. Sometimes when I tighten the corset, I say, isn't it lovely to suffer to be beautiful, right? Suffer to be beautiful. And then for others, it is really a complete loss, a positive loss of self. It's a vacation from self, where you are literally another type of person and one that society has told you is not a real person, right? Women aren't real like men are real to other men, right? They have three dimensions. Women are just like, they're for sex. You have to get married because you have to procreate and you need somebody to clean your house. And to the degree that you can perform being a good father and a good husband, bravo, and remember all of the wedding anniversaries and things like that. This is why weddings are such a big deal, because like you need to like smoke screen, you need to like basically completely snow over the woman into thinking that it's about her, when really it's like the rest of her life is going to be in service to a social ideal. Mm. Not in every case, but we're talking gross generalizations.
Mm. Interesting.
So it's kind of like a little trick, you know, and then the man who's, you know, out there working and needs to have pictures of his wife and kids, preferably the wife needs to be thin and from the right racial background. And that's part of corporate reality, right? There's not a lot of individuation within that. So that's why we see a lot of, again, systemic oppression coming down from corporate reality, is because the culture requires all of its members to look and dress and marry and own the same things, even down to playing golf. Like if you don't want to play golf or tennis, you're done.
I can't with the golf thing. It all trickles down into this image, into this bubble of what it means to be this role in this way. And so this space is the antithesis of that. When anyone is exploring their sexual liberation, it is useful for everybody. And that was interesting what you said about the increase in misogyny and kind of transphobia, because I think there is this sense of, why do they get to do it? How dare they live free when maybe I have feelings of wanting to do this and I feel unable to or incapable of trying this? And how dare other people be free in the way that I can't be? And that can create a lot of hatred and a lot of envy and a lot of really difficult feelings that if you're not addressing can come out in very, you know, violent.
Absolutely. Ways.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Can we shift to clinic play?
Yes.
So that is another one of your specialties. We also wait, before we do that, can you tell me some of the aspects of bondage?
Oh my God.
And what is bondage to you? And what is bondage in general?
Well, I always said that people are just more interesting once they're tied up.
I really thought it was interesting what you said about how for you, it was easier almost to be attracted to a man when they were tied up.
Sure. I don't have any scientific proof of this, but I feel like when I see somebody who is burdened by so much, you know, stress or feeling ill at ease with themselves, I think primarily because of the wounding that I was talking about earlier, mm-hmm. and in the context of a professional dominance session that tends to come to the surface, that when somebody is like that, is tied up, somebody who fits that description, when they are tied up, their body tends to relax and you can feel their relief. It's almost like, would you rather be in a group of people who are crying or at a rock concert where everybody's screaming and having a great time? Mm. You know, you're probably going to want to go to the concert, right? Because you want to be around people who are ecstatic or happy or amused or entertained. It could be the opera. It doesn't have to be a rock concert, right? Mm. And so when there's a certain attunement that happens. And I think when a client comes wanting to be relieved of those types of stresses and wants that accelerator, the bondage is something that gives it to them. And of course, I think there's a lot of tension in the body. Like, how do you feel before a massage?
Tight, you know, tension, stuffy.
And then after a massage?
Looser, freer, more relaxed, more just feeling my skin almost.
Right. And that's the somatic quality of BDSM. And bondage often adds, we can go into all the different aspects of psychology and visual effect and things like that. But the somatic effect of certain kinds of bondage, whether it's painful bondage like shibari suspensions, which are quite uncomfortable for some people, or other kinds that are very, very comfortable from the get-go and continue to sort of lull the person into a trance or lull that person into a real sense of like, I am safe. There's a term called interoception, which is like sense of self. And much of our industrial Western reality comes between us and interoception. It comes between us and our ability to really fully sense ourselves in a way that feels calm and confident. That's why everyone's into meditation now. They're looking for that interoception. Mm. For some people, being tied up gives them access to interoception because it quiets their nervous system in the same way that swaddling a baby can quiet a baby. It releases you from choice, right? You don't have to choose where you are at spatially. It also has effects in the brain where all of a sudden your balance sensors shut off. Your sense of movement through space shuts off. And it shuts off because you can't move. And therefore, the signals you're receiving are all the same over and over and over again. You know, and it's this sort of slow descent from all of the chaotic brain messages that you're getting into a quieter interoception or sense of self, which is profoundly peaceful. And for some people, profoundly erotic, because all of those brain messages are getting in the way of their ability to feel pleasure of any kind.
Yeah. Makes a lot of sense in terms of why it's can be really peaceful or kind of balance that or play with that like pleasure pain experience and just kind of like loss of self.
For the submissive man who is, and not just the bondage fetishist who might not be submissive, for the submissive man who's tied up, there is this sense that he would like to please his dom in a way that is passive. So if I tie somebody up and I say, I like you like that, that's the way I like you. I like you all tied up and helpless. You know, there's that permission, right? They've done, quote unquote, they've done something to please me. And therefore, there is a sense of achievement, right? And having been the right sort of person, and that their desire to be submissive is actually something that I would like them to have. And that's also a very rare experience for men. And for those who crave it, it's really exciting to have a woman say, now that I have you all tied up, now I'm going to take away your ability to talk. Open your mouth and stick a gag in there. And all of a sudden they don't have to say anything. Just the fact that they're there with a gag in their mouth is satisfying to me. Wow. That's a whole nother layer of things they don't have to do.
Totally. It's this permission to not perform or to
perform really. Yeah.
Yeah.
To be responsible in order. That's also kind of a misconception about BDSM is that the bottom is just out of control and that the top is completely in control. Strictly speaking, that's a fantasy that we strive to achieve. Mm. But the reality of it is that the person is never truly out of control.
That really they've controlled this whole experience.
Well, the fact that it's like hypnosis, it doesn't work if you're like, you can't hypnotize me. Right. The other person, yeah, right? You have to be like, okay, I'm gonna try, you know, and then they're right. So yeah, it's the same thing.
Yeah, just this permission to not perform, you know, these very strict
yes
roles yeah. and identities and
that's right
and I can just be free in the presence of somebody and we're both on the same page of this is okay and that we both want this and we both, you know, kind of in this can be so healing and freeing and validating,
especially sexually, because then they can have those pleasurable experiences of maybe being penetrated by a dildo or being spanked and, you know, brought into a greater sense of their bodies, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, there's probably people out there who will say, yeah, base jumping will do the same thing for you. Well, you know, different strokes for different folks, right?
Right. Not everyone wants to base jump.
Right.
Yeah.
Or go to one of those like boot camp things and, you know, but it's the same urge to like, I need to access my body because Western industrial culture is not giving me enough of that.
Yeah, like attunement to body and access to my body in the ways that are not accessible really in my day-to-day life.
That's it.
Because it can't really be, and it's kind of meant to be that way almost. The systems kind of want it. that way.
So more convenient if everybody wears a business suit and has the same haircut. Diversity is one of the reasons we're getting such a huge, you know, backlash against diversity, is because it's inefficient for systems for people to be diverse. And we don't know how to create systems that thrive on diversity. So we are trying to create systems that thrive on diversity. And it's against capitalism, you know, like it really is. Like if we could just, if the capitalism says, if we could just create a society where every single person is buying these things on this particular schedule, right? And these certain ways, that's very efficient for us. We'll know exactly how much to make, what to make, what color to make it. And that's how we're going to get ahead. I'm always thinking, like, why are we so hard on each other, right? Yeah. Like, why is this such a problem to have people doing things that are in their nature and express their authenticity? Why is that such an issue politically, legally, medically? Why is that a problem? Why nobody suffers, right? Well, yeah. Capitalism suffers. And in many ways, organized religion suffers, you know. Mm. These are all systems.
The systems suffer when questioning begins to occur, you know. Clinic play. Let's jump to that. So that is another one of your specialties. Tell me what clinic play is. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I'll start with how I personally became really interested in clinic
play. Love that, yes.
I was a child that had two working parents. They were very busy. And I never really felt as though anybody really paid attention to what was going on in my body. And I had pains. I was sick a lot. You know, I was not like a healthy kid. But when I went to the doctor, they would ask me how I felt. And it was almost as though like a white angel had come into my world, you know, when you're very young. And this person was going to try and help me. So clinic fetish is at its base a helping type of session, right? So we're going to help you to be the best slave you can be. We're going to help you to be the best patient you can be. We're going to make you feel better. Oh, but I'm scared. Don't worry. This is for, we don't like to have to do this to you, but this is in your best interests. Nurse knows best. Or Mad Dr. Wildfire, who's running the asylum and, you know, or the prison. And one of the patients wants to get out early. Well, they can sign on the dotted line to be experimented on and be released early. Oh, that's great. Uh-oh, what does the contract say? Well, the contract says that you have to leave as a female.
I never thought about it that way, in the sense of like your of how you became into it, because you felt kind of like, oh, you can kind of have an experience at a clinic or a doctor's office, or like care, like you're receiving like health care.
Right.
What are some aspects of clinic play? Like, do you, and I guess before you answer that, do you find that the specializations that you have developed as a pro-dom and the areas that you are most attracted to within PDSM play, are those things that you personally enjoyed the most as well?
I'm a person who likes variety. Right. So I was a golf pro. I would probably be a great golf pro, and I would love to play in the rain. I would love to play in the sunshine. I would love to play on, you know, or tennis player, like play on clay and play on grass and, you know, like all the different techniques and all those kinds of things. But I wouldn't necessarily want to play golf on my day off. And so I would say that yes and no. I think there are a lot of things that aren't in the BDSM world that are very interesting to me.
Totally.
And that whole idea that either you're like a top or a bottom or into SM or not into SM or kinky or not kinky, I think is much more fluid than that. And, you know, it's sort of, well, she's just professional and she's not really into it, you know, that kind of thing. Those sorts of binaries are just completely useless. You know,
there have been
long periods where I've really been into the scene personally and long periods of time where I've explored all kinds of other things, including being alone. So do I personally enjoy them? Absolutely. Without that, it's sort of one of the most free creative environments that you could ever hope for, whether you're therapeutically minded or whether you're theatrically minded or whether I also design my own equipment and outfits, and I'm constantly finding new ways to be a creative person in a way that most women of my generation don't typically find. And it is sort of an unexplored frontier. So I feel like I can go in any direction and find something new and exciting. Right now I'm designing a bondage cart. So like a Hannibal Lecter cart, but with something that, with elements that I have added in, that's very exciting and fun.
Yeah, that's really cool. What else have you designed, or what are you designing?
There's a rubber doll scene that I do called Marie Antoinette. I designed a metal straitjacket and metal hoop skirts to go under the dress. And there's a whole bondage rigmarole that goes on. It's like a seat that the doll sits in that prevents them from going anywhere and impales them on a dildo. There are designed a special cage, the Basket of Swords cage. And I'm also making a giant wig out of rubber sausage curls for the Marie Antoinette doll. I have to admit, you know, I didn't have a lot of toys when I was a kid.
That's cool. So yeah.
Fun to have human dolls.
That's really cool. That's really interesting. And kind of the perfect Marie Antoinette hair, which I never thought the curl, you know, that's really funny. That's really cool. So with Clinic Play, what are some of the potential aspects of Clinic Play? Sure.
Well, there's lots of different kinds of nurses in the world, right? So there's a school nurse, maybe the headmistress sent the naughty schoolboy to the nurse, and because he keeps acting out and perhaps he's constipated, so he needs an enema, but he has to be punished because he's been pulling the girl's pigtails. So this is a grown man playing the role of a younger boy. And so he gets a hand spanking and then an enema, and then perhaps, you know, some soothing talk from the nurse. So that's one example of role play with a nurse. It could also be a nurse at a prison, right? And a sadistic prison nurse that nobody's overseeing her. And so she gets to do whatever she wants to the prisoner. And there's no way he can escape. So there's no limits to her sadism. For others in a nurse scene, the gender change scenario is also very, very popular, and that could take all kinds of forms. A boss annoys or sexually harasses his secretary. And so the secretary, as the scenario goes, sends him to a new clinic in town that will set him straight. And so he's, you know, tied up and forced to undergo his routine physical, which somehow also includes a lot of cock and ball and tit torture, because that's, you know, the new OSHA requirements or the new HIPAA requirements.
That's what has to happen. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. You know, it really is. It sounds like, particularly with your work and specializations, there's so much confrontation of the gender binary for a lot of the, you know, people that you work with, in that, and it's needed, right? Like, this is like, looking at on a, you know, zoomed out level, looking at and playing with the binaries that keep us caged, you know, and kind of what, how they impact us, our psyches, you know, our self-expression, and really useful in the sense that creating a space where these things can be challenged and played with and explored in a safe, you know, negotiated environment, and just how healing, you know, like I would love, you know, as a person assigned female at birth and who identifies as a woman, like, and who has been treated as such their whole lives, you know, it would be, I mean, many aspects of either role would be so freeing to experience in a safe, consensual environment, you know, that where there's no kind of expectation attached to those roles in the way outside life there is.
And it's fun. It's fun to have a session where you have a specific role to play. It's fun to have a session where the body is treated a different way. There aren't any roles at all. Hey, I want to experience this. Great. Let's do that. And my practice does involve a lot of questioning or reversing or transgressing the binary. And that's what I find particularly interesting for me. There are a million different interpretations of what a top or a dominatrix can be. And I think as we become more aware of how all of us are to a degree gender fluid and how the binary doesn't necessarily naturally fit a great percentage of us, we probably see a lot of changes in the way professional dominance is practiced.
Yeah. What is your typical process for developing your scenes? Do you prefer to kind of someone share with you what they're looking for, and then you take, you know, you kind of think of the scenario and the scene and all of that, or is it more of a collaborative? And I know that it probably varies person to person, but like,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Some people are extremely scripted, even down to like 15 minutes for this, 10 minutes for that. And that's their foreplay with themselves, is to script the scene. And then it's my job to make it seem absolutely seamless, like I thought of it myself. And of course, I'm going to add my own little flourishes. And I rather pride myself on being able to conjure the exact tone for somebody like that. And then there are other people who come in who are like, you know, mistress, we've been seeing each other for 20 years and I trust you, and, you know, surprise me. So there are very specific categories that people fall into, but most people want to try new and varied things so they can experience their body and their psyche and their body mind in all these different ways. And there are probably a much smaller percentage of people who want exactly the same thing over and over again. And even they, over the course of 20 or 30 years, and there are some clients that I have seen for over 20 years, who have slowly but surely, I think, due to the internet and FetLife and all these wonderful sources of information, they'll come in and they'll be like, I know we've never done this before, but would it be okay if we did this as well? As what we usually do, you know? So that's neat to see people, again, giving themselves permission because they saw it online. You know, they saw that other people did it, so it must not be that horrible, right?
Totally. Yeah, like exposure to it. Or just even, you know, seeing that it exists.
And seeing that it's okay to ask for it. It's okay to be the person who says, I want, you know, a vibrating butt plug, you know, or I want to wear my penis in a chastity. Those are not things that you typically see portrayed in life. Our culture is extremely sex phobic. And so we don't get to talk about bodily functions, let alone, you know, kinky sexuality.
Totally. Absolutely.
The value in going to see a pro dom or to talk to a real live pro dom or to attend a chat online or something like that is that this is real life validation of who you are and what you are able to do with your body should you choose to.
The value. Totally. Yes. Like it's like an a validation of the value and just of like, it's okay. You didn't invent this and you're certainly not the only one.
Absolutely. And that's the case for a lot of those things. I think that we all wish for, to a degree, a benevolent other, a benevolent other to give us permission to be who we really are. Now, obviously you can't depend on that because you have to give that permission to yourself, but it's generally true and it can act as an accelerator for greater personal pleasure, whether it's sexual or interception, like we were talking earlier. You know, it's a value to be given permission to be authentic.
Yeah. And can really help along your journey to get when maybe we're not ready to give ourselves that permission. You know, we can have a benevolent other to help us along the way. One last question before we close. How have you changed over the years in terms of like the way you view your work, the way you view yourself, the way you view your sexuality? Like, I know that's a huge question, but have you gained more acceptance for yourself if you didn't have it at one point? Or have you, like, what have you learned about yourself?
I guess I had to give everyone else permission to be themselves first and to see them be brave. Maybe there was a part of me that was really holding back or felt like I didn't need to do that. I wasn't brave enough to do it, or I didn't have any reason to do it. And I think over 30 years, you finally realize that you have just as much right. I feel like I have just as much right now to be who I am in whatever body I happen to find myself, you know, in whatever state I happen to be, in terms of my gender, my orientation, my body, my existence, right? And so after a lifetime of giving other people's permission, I thought, okay, all right, well, I have a little permission left over. I'll give it to myself.
I so relate. I love that. Yes, I love that. Thank you so much. Where any closing remarks from you or any closing things that we didn't talk about that you wanted to?
I am really grateful for this opportunity, Sarah. We haven't had a chance to connect at IC, and I'm so glad that you put that out there. And this is the sort of work that I see myself doing. So thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Sure. I'm so grateful that you wanted to come on. And where do you want to share, like, where we can find you? Or you mentioned a book, which I want to purchase. Like, where can we find you if we want to, or connect, or anything sure. like that?
Well, I'm on Instagram, Reb Holmberg, and my professional self, Amanda Wildfire, is also on Instagram, Real Amanda Wildfire. I'm starting up a class series for people who are interested in becoming professional dominants, and that's coming by the end of the year. Book is in progress. There'll be actually 3 books, an autobiography, a bondage, a book all about bondage, the great big book of bondage. And there will be a book on how to be a professional dominant or play just like one.
Wow. That's so exciting. Are you self-publishing or do you have, or where are you in the process?
I don't have a plan yet. I think my plan is to finish the manuscript. That is what is exciting for me right now.
And, yes.
To finish IC and to do lots of writing there. Mm. But yeah, AmandaWildfire.com and RebHolmberg.com is the best place to find me. And
thank you for listening to another episode of Psych in the City. You can find me, your host, on Instagram at PsychInTheCityBK or at my website, sarah-kelleher.com. You can find Reb, aka Mistress Amanda Wildfire, at rebholmberg.com or at amandawildfire.com, WILDEFYRE, or on Instagram at realamandawildfire or at reb.holmberg. Hope you liked it.